Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
From the Wholesale Link Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. This is the Home Plate Podcast with Ryan Port and Calvin Smith. Talking all things baseball in the city of Nashville.
Just a bit outside.
On Nashville's best sports talk.
ESPN.
102.5 The Game.
Welcome in to another edition of the Home Plate Podcast here on ESPN 102.5 The Game and TheGameNashville.com. Ryan Porth, Calvin Smith here with you. Little playoff edition of the Home Plate Podcast. We'll be getting into a lot of different playoff topics, I guess you could say, with Kurt Casale.
Really everything baseball.
Everything baseball. But we will start with the playoffs with Kurt Casale, Cincinnati Reds catcher, formerly with the Vanderbilt Commodores. A really good conversation. Looking forward to having him in studio with us.
Yes.
As he spends his offseason here in Nashville. Yeah. So that was pretty cool. But Calvin, I wanted to ask you, as you're watching game four of the NLCS,
yep,
the first inning, did it make you feel any better as a Braves fan that the Nationals put a seven spot on the Cardinals in the first inning? As like,
no, it makes me feel
karma.
Worse, because the Braves lost to a team who got swept by a team they beat in the division. What? How? Who? That doesn't make any sense.
They didn't even lead. They didn't have a lead at all at any point in the NLCS.
And there was no point during this season where anybody thought the Nationals were better than the Atlanta Braves.
Well, no, but I will say, I have been drinking that Washington Nationals Kool-Aid for a long time.
You have.
It was really cool to see. They are the first team ever in baseball to be 12 games under 500 at one point during the year and make it to the World Series.
At what point were they? Was that
was
that
around
been,
Memorial Day?
Okay, I was gonna say, was that in May?
19 and 30. They were 19 and 31.
Yeah, jeez. No, but no. To go back to what your question, no, that does not make me feel any better because there's just no scenario where that series played out like it did.
Well,
either both actually. Well, okay, the Braves Cardinals series that should have played out like it did, or it could have. But the Nationals Cardinals one, I mean. Just outright sweep and utter domination? What?
Well, we were texting during game one in St. Louis as Anibal Sanchez was trying to throw a no-hitter. He didn't. But when Sanchez was doing that to the Cardinals, we were texting and being like, look, if this is what Sanchez is doing to the Cardinals, just wait for Scherzer and Strasburg and Corbin. And sure enough, they just mowed down the Cardinals.
Well, if Anibal Sanchez is that guy, then we'll actually have a good World Series, too. A surprisingly good World Series, because whoever comes out of the AL is probably going to be heavily favored and thought of as, by the media, by Vegas, by the fans, is, okay, well, the Astros are probably going to take this one in 5. The Yankees probably get this one in 6, whatever.
People view Astros-Yankees as the de facto World Series.
It basically feels like it, looking at it on paper, but hey, they still have games to play, and we get into this with Kurt Casale a little bit later on today. The Nationals pitchers, something about them is just special.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're all very good. They all have filthy stuff. But right now, they're just on fire. In baseball, like basketball is a game of swings, right? Like you go on a 10-point run, the other team goes on an 8-point run. Well, baseball is like that over 162 games. You go on a 20-game stretch where you're good and a 20-game stretch where you're awful. Clearly, the Nationals were not very good to start the season, and now they're on this insane hot streak.
The last time we did the podcast last week was basically right after Dave Roberts pooped his pants.
Yes,
for the LA Dodgers in
you
Game
many
Five
words
against the
for
Nationals.
Dave Roberts.
And yes, I did. And we basically said that this Nationals team is a team of destiny, and here they are,
knocking on the door. I mean, then they have every opportunity, right? I don't think I will pick them in the World Series either way. I think it's more likely for me to pick them if the Yankees make it, but a team of destiny sounds right because Juan Soto just seems primed to just have his like name written in folklore with something he'll do in the World Series. If the Nationals are the team that are going to get there, that's how I see it playing out. Is Juan Soto, the young kid, the young superstar with all kinds of swagger on the field, comes in and does something miraculous. And if they are a team of destiny, I can't get it out of my mind that somehow he is the crux of them winning a World Series.
Well, he's already done some spectacular things in the playoffs. Yeah, the game-winning hit against the Brewers. He had the game-tying home run off Clayton Kershaw in Game 5 of the NLDS. He wasn't as good in the NLCS, but I tell you what, Anthony Rendon is hitting like over 400 in the playoffs. Yep. Every time he's at the plate, it feels like he's about to mash it. Either a single, double could be a home run. Rendon is just something special right now, and not only offensively, but he made a defensive play. I believe it was Game 3 of the NLCS. Mm-hmm. That was just sick. So this Nationals team, even if they don't win the World Series, it definitely has been a fun ride for all those fans in D.C.
Just like Bryce Harper said, they want to bring a title back to D.C. If you don't know what we're referencing there, Bryce Harper, we had it as a soundbite earlier in the year, actually,
it may
on
have
the
been
podcast.
One of our first podcasts as the soundbite of the week.
But Bryce Harper said into a microphone in a Philadelphia Phillies uniform in a Phillies hat at his official signing, "We just really want to bring a title back to D.C. Mm. Complete mess up by him. He didn't mean D.C., but he said D.C. out of habit. And he seems to have helped done that.
And now they're in the World Series. And he is not. And he's about to have Dusty Baker as his manager again.
Have fun with that.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's not waste any more time. Kurt Casale of the Vanderbilt Commodores, formerly, and currently with the Cincinnati Reds, nice enough to join us here in studio. Kurt, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I like talking baseball.
Well, it is your livelihood.
It is.
But I'm always curious by this. When a team is done and the player season is over, do you continue to watch? Have you been watching the playoffs here in October?
I have. Probably not as thoroughly as the rest of the fan base has been, but I've been keeping tabs on it. And I may not watch start to finish because the games are just, they're very, very long right now. And it kind of just upsets me that I'm still not playing, and it's just kind of gut wrenching. But for the most part, I'm up to date.
Yeah, I was up until midnight for that Astros Yankees game two, the walk off homer, barely keeping my eyes open. But I got to tell you, these playoffs have been very intriguing. Mm-hmm. Just with the Nationals Dodgers series, how the Braves Cardinals series went. Sorry, Calvin. Calvin's a Braves fan.
Oof.
Yeah, sorry about that.
This Astros Yankee series, like, there's just a whole lot of intrigue, whole lot of drama late in games right now, and I think that is really good for the sport of baseball.
I think for the past few years, the playoffs have been really entertaining to watch. I mean, with some good storylines as well. You know, like, you know, Boston winning it last year. Houston the year before, and just a lot of good things happening in our game right now, and this year is no different. I think the Yankees are one of the powerhouses, and they're playing like it too. Mm-hmm. Houston is, you know, obviously an unbelievable team. I think the LA Dodgers getting kicked out was kind of a surprise to a lot of people, and they've had a great couple of years, but they got to figure something out in the playoffs, because back-to-back World Series losses and then an early exit in the NLDS is not what LA expects. But I think the Nationals story is pretty cool. Everybody kind of views them as almost like a Cinderella, which I don't really get because of their insane payroll they have on that team. Yeah. But invisible boundaries that they haven't been able to get through in the past, just in terms of, you know, from Montreal to Washington and things like that. But I'm happy to see them doing well, and somebody new getting to the World Series, and they got a great team. They got a great team, and I think the most important thing about being a playoff team is getting hot at the right time, and the Nationals are just in fuego right now.
I'm just curious, staying along with the Nationals, when you know they have guys like Scherzer, Strasburg, and Corbin who are going to come at you every night, as a hitter, how daunting of a task is that for you at the highest level, and how do you approach that night in and night out knowing they have such great guys?
It is daunting for sure. It's the meetings are a little bit more serious in going into those games, just because those guys just don't give up runs, and it really becomes just a matter of, okay, how do we score 2 runs off of these guys and not give up any against the rest of their hitters? And you know, that's a task in itself because those guys are so good, like Strasburg and Max Scherzer, and, you know, Patrick Corbin has been really, really good for them as well. But it's tough. It really is tough, and especially more difficult if you don't play in their division. I think if you're, you know, like your team, the Braves, sorry about that. they probably have a better chance of, you know, getting to them because they play them more often. Mm-hmm. You know, they play them 19 times over the course of a year. But if we play them, you know, we run into a brick wall and we're like, all right, this is probably not going to work out well for us. I'd be curious to see what those pitchers' records were against non-divisional teams because it's definitely an advantage to see these guys multiple times and get into a rhythm with them. But man, not something that you really want to go into and have to do on a frequent basis. Yeah. So those guys are legit pitchers.
Well, how from night to night would your approach change when you're facing a Scherzer versus a Strasburg? Because I know Corbin's a lefty, it's a little bit different, but two guys who can throw hard but have wicked stuff as well. How does your approach change on a night-to-night basis?
That's a really tough question. It's, you know, both guys have slightly different, you know, sets of pitches. You know, Strasburg obviously still throws hard, not quite as hard as he used to, but, you know, I've been seeing him in the playoffs just throwing six straight curveballs to hitters, and that's just, you know, based on their scouting report. But his pitch is probably his changeup and or split finger, whatever you want to call it. And Scherzer, he kind of takes his game to different levels depending on the point in the at-bat, the point in the game. When he starts grunting, that's a bad sign.
Did you see the video on Twitter of him cussing the guy out while he was mid-pitch?
I did not see that. I want to go look at it. But like that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's a different point in the game, and that's when he becomes, you know, quote-unquote Mad Max, and he starts throwing 98, 99, and yelling at you. So, you know, I guess, you know, Scherzer kind of uses the intimidation factor probably a little bit more than Strasburg, and Strasburg might just, you know, outstuff you to death. But those are two insane pitchers. I tell you what, they're not fun to face.
Well, and that's what the great ones can do, right? They can dial it up in those key situations. We've seen Justin Verlander do it for years, and Max Scherzer in this postseason has been doing that even out of the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an impressive pitching staff for sure. They don't have a deep bullpen, which has made it tough on Davey Martinez to get through some of these games and use those guys out of the bullpen as well, which is always an interesting strategy to think about, using your starters out of the bullpen when you need them maybe two or three nights later in a playoff series.
Yeah, ask Dave Roberts about that with Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah.
You know, that's, that one kind of bit him. You know, he did his job, and then he sent him back out, and then it's just back-to-back Rendon, Soto, back-to-back homers, and there's just season over basically after that. But
yeah,
I think like a common trend in the past like 10 years is dominant bullpens win postseason series, you know, with, you know, last year with the Red Sox and then the Astros before that. But the Nationals are trying it a different way, I guess, and because they don't have to. I mean, they've got a, well, now it seems like they got a four-headed monster at the top of that rotation with Anibal Sanchez doing really, really well as well. But it's kind of, you know, you're probably not going to have both, you know, unless you were able to afford a $300 million payroll and just get crushed by the luxury tax. But I think the, speaking of like the starters and just how that is a different strategy, I think it's interesting to see how Max Scherzer is reacting to all this, you know, all the winning that they're doing and how far they're getting. Like, first of all, I think it's so interesting that he always wears a jersey, even though he's not even anywhere close to pitching. Like most starting pitchers don't wear their jersey on when they're not up. It's almost like he always is wanting to pitch. Like, even if he started the day before and went 8 innings and 110 pitches, like, I'm available today. And he's just like, he's like a kid in a candy store right now. He's so happy. And, it's pretty cool. I actually had a chance to catch him in spring training in 2012 in Detroit when I first got drafted by the Tigers. And he was as passionate then as he is now.
Really?
It's pretty tough to, you know, bring that every single day, but, I'm happy for him. And, you know, he kind of is putting that team on his back a little bit and getting him going.
So to stay on the Nationals train a little bit, as a catcher, you've got Anthony Rendon at 3. You've got Juan Soto at 4. Arguably the best 3-4 combo right now in baseball. How do you go about that approach with your pitcher when you've got a back-to-back like that with Rendon and Soto compared to a 6-7 that isn't as, I guess you could say, as powerful or as fearful as those two can be?
I mean, they're both very hot right now, and they're both just great hitters. I mean, first and foremost, I've been interested to see how they're attacking both of those hitters, and I don't really understand what they're doing because, I don't know. We faced them. I was in the IL the last time they faced them in Washington, but the first time we faced them in Washington, like, we had a great scouting report against them, and we just fed anything away to Rendon or fastballs up. We got him out almost every single time. And then Soto, we just flipped him a bunch of spin. We just threw curveball, and, just got ahead of him. And it just seems like nobody's trying to do that. And I don't really understand why, because, I mean, it's the playoffs, and they may be trying to, and they're just not executing. But
yeah,
Rendon is a, he's a low ball hitter. He's a low ball hitter. His hands are low. It's hard to get it up. It's hard to hit a high fastball or anything with velo up there. And they just keep feeding it to him, especially what Kershaw did to give him a nice low. I think it was might have even been a curveball or a slider at the bottom of the zone. And,
I'd say it was almost below the zone.
It was almost below the zone.
At his shins.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He wants the ball down.
Yeah.
He wants the ball down, and that's where he does the majority of his damage. And, Soto is probably the exact opposite. He's a decent high ball hitter and doesn't handle down as much, and he doesn't handle spin, so curveballs and sliders underneath the zone. So I'm waiting for him to try it.
Yeah.
I really am. But,
well, that's what the Cardinals did, though. Adam Wainwright, when he faced Soto, just curveball, got him out.
Yeah. No, there you go.
Yeah.
There is a way to get most people out, and usually it's just one pitch. And but that's what's so difficult about baseball. It's just like, it's hard to repeat that and do it over and over without missing. And these hitters are too good, and when you miss, they absolutely make it hurt.
Over time in the bigs, how much can a player develop the ability to hit a pitch it's their kryptonite at the beginning of the career? Like we saw it with Dansby Swanson. The slider just killed him early on in his career, especially anything that broke down and out on him. He seemed to swing at it every time almost. How do you develop in your career to, hey, if you see this pitch, don't swing or swing at it at this point and leverage the situation you're in?
Well, I mean, not to talk about myself too much, but like, I'm here, and this is a great question and something that I've had to dissect in my own personal game for growth. You don't get to the big leagues without being able to hit a fastball, right? You've got to be an unbelievable fastball hitter, and that's how, you ascend through the minor leagues, and that's how you get your chance in the big leagues. And as soon as you get to the big leagues, you don't see a lot of them. It's just like, or you see them when you don't ever expect them. 2-0, 2-1, 3-1 hitters counts, they're not guaranteed fastballs anymore. I'd say it's probably shifted to, hitters counts, we're getting something spinning. And it took me to really figure out a way to combat that and match that challenge. And just a perfect example, like last year, I think I was looking at my numbers against right-handed breaking balls, and it was like 150 I was batting against those. So I was like, I got to figure out something to do or just learn how to hit it or learn how to sit on it and let a fastball go if I get one. And this year I hit 330 off of breaking balls.
Nice.
So
what'd you change?
I learned how to sit on a breaking ball. But the thing is, when you sit on a breaking ball over the course of an at bat, I mean, this is prior to two strikes. Like two strikes, you just got to battle and do whatever you can. But it takes the discipline to, if it's 0-0 and I'm sitting on a breaking ball and he throws me a 91 mile an hour fastball right down the middle, I have to take it and not give in and put a mediocre or B swing on that pitch in hopes that I get the one that I'm actually waiting for. And, the proof is in the pudding. My numbers worked out well that year and arguably my best offensive season so far. So interesting that you brought that up because it was something that I definitely tried to make happen.
Well, you mentioned the numbers, and I'm a huge numbers guy. Like
you are.
I'm the Moneyball, all of that stuff. But beyond that, I mean, I've read a bunch of books like Keith Law's Smart Baseball, if you're familiar with that, and all the analytics and things like Driveline. And the Reds just hired Kyle Bodie and all of these things. And, of course, they bring in Trevor Bauer. Yep. That means Kyle Bodie is right there as well. How involved are you in any of that process with pitch tracking technology as a catcher, helping your pitchers from that aspect, or on the hitting side, scouting yourself with any kind of video that goes in super slow motion like that?
In terms of like the Driveline part and the Repsoto machine and the Edgetronic cameras, that's not really my purview. That's actually Caleb Gotham, who's a former Vanderbilt Commodore, as well as our assistant pitching coach. He's a guru in that, because he spent a bunch of time at Driveline with Kyle and with Trevor. So that's them. But I think, you know, me and Tucker Barnhart, we do a lot of scouting on our own, as well as, you know, Derek Johnson, our pitching coach. But I think it's Caleb's job, and it now will be Kyle's, to determine what is the pitcher's best mix of pitches. So how fast is he spinning his fastball? How many RPMs does he have on his slide or a curveball? Or how much perceived rise does it have? Mm-hmm. And then it's their job to convey to us that we think this guy is an up-down guy, is an east-west guy, or if he's something else that we don't really know. So, like, with a few of our pitchers, let's just, for instance, Anthony DeSclafani for us, we really tried to go fastballs at the top of the zone because he had a lot of carry on his fastball, and he was getting hit on balls that were down in the zone. So it's kind of like, if you've been following Twitter, you see these GIFs or memes or whatever the hell they
pitching
are.
Ninja.
Pitching Ninja, like the overlays.
Yep.
And that's exactly the point, because they all look the same as to a certain point, but they all have to start at the same point in order for you to really gain the tactic that you're trying to do with the hitter. Like, you're trying to change your eye level. We're trying to figure out where he's looking. The hitter is looking in the first place. Is he tunneling a fastball inside, or is he looking away? Is he looking up? Is he looking down? And it's our job to be able to determine. It's me and Tucker's job to be able to determine that right away. And that's where we got to start our pitches and then make them chase everything off of that. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. You'd be really interested in some of the stuff that we do, but super excited for Kyle to come in. I can't wait to meet him, and you know, even more excited to see you know, what Trevor can do over the course of an off season. And it's you know, hopefully we add, you know, step two to our pitching plan, because our pitchers just lit it up last year. It was a really, really nice change and a 180 from our direction from the previous year. And now, as long as our offense can catch up, we'll be in pretty good shape.
Is it nice to see that from an organization, something that you were already doing well, and then them adding fuel to the fire to keep it going, to ensure that's going to continue to happen?
Yeah, I think it's I think they now realize that it's a strength of ours. And I think nobody would ever think that it's a strength of a Cincinnati Reds baseball team, just because of the ballpark that we play in. But if you got good pitchers and you got a good plan, doesn't matter what ballpark you're in, you can make it work.
I think back in the 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013 seasons where the Reds made the playoffs 3 out of 4 years, those pitching staffs proved that you can win in that ballpark, where I think there was a preconceived notion that you couldn't. Like, Johnny Cueto wasn't a fly ball pitcher in a Reds uniform. He won a lot of games, even at Great American Ballpark. Matt Latos was successful in Cincinnati. Homer Bailey was successful for a few years in Cincinnati, where there's this almost Coors Field type mantra around the Reds of, well, they're not going to win with good pitching because you can't pitch well in that ballpark. There are ways around it, for sure.
There are, and to compare it to Coors Field is just not even remotely close. That place is a circus. I don't know if you followed our series against the Rockies in Denver this year, but it was one of the weirdest baseball series I've ever played in my life.
It was bipolar.
It was strange. It just didn't feel like baseball. I mean, it was And then on top of that, the way that they cut their outfield grass, it like any ground ball, it just snakes. And I've never seen so many balls misplayed in the outfield in my entire life, really. And I just can't imagine why they don't change the way that they cut that grass, because it kills their outfielders and it just creates so many more opportunities for runs. But the so the Coors Field, that's not really a great comparison, but in terms of like the challenge to pitch in those particular ballparks, it is different. God, it's so funny. So we're talking about Coors Field, but so like breaking balls don't really break there. It's just like it's just fact. Like nobody really gets to spin the ball and it really breaks. But man, Sonny pitched there this year, and their hitters were just yelling expletives. Like how the hell is this breaking as much as it? Like he was scaring hitters because they had never seen a curveball break as much as his does at Coors Field. I was just laughing back there. I'm just like, well, that's what he does.
That's Sonny.
That's Sonny. Like, and that's surprise.
And that's a good Rockies lineup.
It's a really good Rockies lineup, especially there.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Arenado, Story,
and they were dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. They were dumbfounded. It was really, really funny. But
yeah. Well, speaking of Sonny, mm-hmm. you said to us before we started here that you just saw Sonny, I guess, yesterday.
Yeah.
He had an amazing season.
Sure did.
Arguably his best season as a pro, even though a lot of people look at win-loss records. He was 11-8. But you look at the strikeout numbers, you look at the ERA, you look at him being a bulldog on the mound for a lot of different games this season for the Reds. He was outstanding. Why did he have such a turnaround from his days with the Yankees and even a couple seasons prior to that?
I really think people were tough on him in New York, and I'd be one of the first ones to say that I was completely shocked when it didn't really go well in New York. I thought he would go into New York and just absolutely kill it, because he's a guy that really steps up and big situations are in a spotlight. But New York is New York; it doesn't work for everybody, and that's just kind of that's kind of an excuse that the journalists in New York gave, and they just picked him as their punching bag to pick on. And I was so happy that we traded for him. Big props to our GM Nick Kroll and Derek Johnson, our former pitching coach, for getting that done, because he was a leader on our team, and he made even more of an impact in the locker room than he did on the field. But on the field, he was he was our guy. I mean, we had Luis Castillo as well, who had a great year as well. But Sonny was beyond consistent. We talked about the Rapsodo and the driveline thing, and Sonny spins the ball better than anybody in baseball, mm-hmm. in terms of how he throws a curveball. And we just decided to call it more, and just he's got great control of his curveball. I'd be curious to see what percentage of the time we called it, but I put a heck of a lot of number twos down, and a lot of two seamers in at righty's hands, and just creating deception, and just setting it up for, hey, here's your curveball, try and hit it. And nobody hit it.
Well, and he was dominant at Vanderbilt, and you played with him at mm-hmm. Vanderbilt. Was he better this season in Cincinnati than he was at Vanderbilt in your eyes?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. He in college, he still had the same stuff he has now. I venture to say his stuff is better now, just because he's older and he's a pro and he does this every day for a living now. But he'd be the first one to tell you he didn't really know where his fastball was going in college. I mean, he had like a general idea of where it was going to go, but he was throwing a two seamer that would cut, it would sink, it would ride, and now he's gotten to the point where he's able to throw a four seamer and a two seamer that's kind of going in different areas, but. He's hitting my glove. He's hitting Tucker's glove, and he's just not making a lot of mistakes, and mm-hmm. Striking out a lot of people in the process, and really, putting us on his back and taking us to a lot of wins with him on the mound. I know his record doesn't reflect it, but post All-Star break, I think it was, he got on a bender, and
oh yeah,
and he really really did some crazy things, and this is all with. I don't know if you guys, he was some pretty serious bone chips in his elbow.
I know. And that's really impressive.
He the amount of work he had to do, not to spill too much of his, you know, in between starts, but he had to put a lot of work into to prepare for each and every start. And I would anticipate even better things for Sunday next year, just because he's not going to be riddled with all that nonsense.
So obviously you knew he was going through that during the season, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of challenge was that for Sonny to battle through that in between starts and then go out there and then throw 6, 7, 8 great innings consistently?
I'm sure it was a challenge for him. I think it's a better question for him to answer, but
yeah.
If I were to guess, I think he had good days and bad days, and you know, we knew when the good days were and we knew when the bad days were, but you know, it might have just changed to, you know, whether he was smiling more that day or, you know, if his arm was hurting, like, yeah, we kind of knew, but it didn't ever affect him going out and missing a start because he didn't miss any starts. He, you know, he put together a complete season, and that's, you know, you get rewarded with an all-star, you know, an all-star game there, and you know, you're just nominated for National League Comeback Player of the Year, which I hope he wins because he deserves it. Whether he wants that or not, I don't know. But he, you know, he was our guy. He helped change our culture around our pitching staff, and now he's getting paid a lot of money to do that because he's certainly delivered.
For the exact numbers on Sonny Gray. Yeah. He basically threw a curveball every time he threw a fastball. He threw a fastball about 28% of the time, a curveball about 25%.
Wow.
And then a slider 21%. Yeah. And that's a huge uptick from last season, and that's nuts. But also across the league, I feel like that's kind of something that's going on. You're seeing a lot more breaking pitches. And something I was always taught as a young player was don't throw the curveball too early. Like, don't throw it too often either because it causes injuries because of what you're doing to your elbow. Does that hold any water in the bigs at this point, or is that kind of going away? Because I know that's something, you know, places like Driveline and a lot of pitching mechanics people are fighting against or pushing for.
That's a good question. You know, Trevor Bauer throws as many breaking balls as probably anybody in baseball, and to my knowledge, he's not had any, knock on wood, any arm problems, and it's because of, I would assume it's because of his insane routine over the course of a week. And he works so hard. It's really impressive to see what he puts together over the course of a day. But he's out there. Like, he's got a rubber arm because of it. Mm-hmm. Like, he's doing these weighted balls. He throws left-handed, and it's for symmetry. And I'm like, that's genius. Like, honestly, our hitters have taken that into the cage, and then we hit a lot left, like opposite hand, just to, you know, give, you know, equal balance and, you know, equal stretching to our spine. And so, like, something like that is just as simple from Trevor Bauer. And so back to, like, the curveball thing, I think as long as you're taking care of your arm and you're throwing it the right way, then you should be good. I mean, Sonny's throwing more curveballs than anybody. And, like, as long as you're doing it properly, and you've set your arm up, and your arm is, you know, your shoulder and your scap and all the tiny muscles in your throwing arm are healthy and they're being taken care of and they're strengthening, then I really don't think there's any problem to it. But I do think that the curveball is going to come back in baseball. It kind of had a little hiatus for a while because everybody got really, you know, hopped up on the slider, the 90-mile-an-hour slider, and it's still a good pitch, but I think a curveball is harder to hit.
As a hitter, what would you rather hit, a curveball or a slider?
I'd rather hit a slider.
You'd rather, why?
It doesn't break as much.
Yeah.
I guess most people's don't break as much. I think if you throw a good curveball like Sonny's, it's moving horizontally as much as it's moving vertically. So that's two changes of direction technically that you have to match with your bat and your eyes. A slider is just moving, you know, for the most part, horizontally. You know, there might be a little bit of depth, and that's when you really get a lot of swing and misses, but I'd rather have the one that moves a little bit than the one that moves a lot.
So I'm going to put you in a hypothetical situation that is completely unfair.
Okay, right, cool.
You've got two outs, you've got two strikes, you've got runners on base, you're catching. Let's say 6th, 7th, 8th inning, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Two strikes on a hitter. Are you calling the Luis Castillo changeup? Are you calling the Amir Garrett slider or the Sonny Gray curveball?
Ooh. What's the count?
just two strikes.
0-2, 1-2.
Let's
it
say,
makes a difference.
Let's say 2-2.
2-2. Ooh. All right, what hand is the batter?
Well, that does that does impact.
Sorry, I'm
it,
ruining it. I'm ruining it. I'm ruining your question. These are things that I think about. It's a lefty.
Amir Garrett, right?
Well, it doesn't have to be. Okay. I think. All right, so like, all right, let's just break it down. All right, if you don't mind.
Okay,
go for it.
If there's a lefty hitter up there right now, first and foremost, I would take Amir Garrett slider just because he's got tremendous reach. My second would be Sonny's curveball.
Okay.
My third would be Luis's changeup. If it's a righty up, I would pick Amir last just because he's left on right. That's a little unfair. And he has much better success against lefties, but I would take Luis's changeup against a righty over Sonny's curveball. If Sonny was throwing a really good slider that day, it might be a different story. But 2-2 in this day and age is essentially 3-2. I don't want it to get to 3-2. I want to end the bat there. I mm-hmm. want to be able to call the same pitch. I would call 3-2 on 2-2, and that's Luis's changeup. And Sonny wouldn't have his feelings hurt if I said that.
How cool is it though, as a catcher, to be catching three of the best pitches in baseball? Those three that I mentioned there.
Really, really cool. It's you know, for two of them, I'd say it's much cooler. So like when Luis's changeup comes in and when Amir's slider comes in, they're just usually out pitches right away. When Sonny throws his curveball, it might be spiked. And, you know, they might swing it anyways, but that just means that I'm just going to wear one off my forearm. he would just laugh at me. He's like, hey, good block, man. Like, and that's what he sounds like. But it is very cool to get the opportunity to catch some unbelievable pitchers. And those three are, you know, among the best in baseball. And that's omitting a lot of other guys on our team who have really, really great stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. Michael Lorenzen is just a freak of nature. And he's got a great changeup as well. But I feel very fortunate to be in the situation I'm at and get the opportunity to catch the guys I do.
I was really surprised this season by the Tampa Bay Rays. And you spent some time.
I wasn't.
Really? And that's what I'm going to try to get to is you spent time with the organization. Is there anything different about how they function? Because the payroll, a lot of it looking at the beginning of the year, on paper, you would say this team doesn't have any business going out and winning 95 games. But you have experience with how they function. Is it different that kind of leads to the results they get?
Well, they're a pitching and defense organization, first mm-hmm. and foremost. They develop arms and, you know, probably better than any other team in the game at this point, just for the value that they get from them. But the reason I said I wasn't surprised is because the majority of their team now was their AAA team for the past 2 years, and I was a part of that with Durham, and they've won back-to-back national championships. Like they had a big league staff in their rotation and a big league bullpen in AAA, and nobody beat us when we were playing. Like, you know, it's AAA and it's, you know, the competition is different, but like if we're looking at Tampa, like they just what were they known for in the postseason? Like everybody was talking about their bullpen. Like they didn't really even have to throw a starter out there.
Yeah.
If it was, you know, unless it was Charlie Morton or, you know, kind of a,
yep.
Let's just say like half of what Blake Snell is right now, because he had a, you know, mm-hmm. injury riddled season, which stinks because he's an awesome pitcher and an awesome dude. But their bullpen is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I remember catching Diego Castillo and Durham and AAA, and he's a monster, man. He's so good. And it was only a matter of time before yeah. they finally hit the ground running, and you know, they put the right pieces together on the offensive side of the ball, and it was just a matter of if they were going to score enough runs. And man, I'd be interested to see if they played who the Yankees play first. If they play the Twins or the Yankees first, there might be a completely different mm-hmm. series.
Yeah.
But they just got matched up with Houston and
yep.
and you know,
and Garrett Cole, who was gonna strike out everybody.
Garrett Cole is just not gonna give up any runs right now. So like,
yeah.
But he doesn't give up runs against anybody. So
yeah.
You know, they got to Verlander, and you know, but you run into Garrett Cole twice, you're gonna lose.
Yeah. So that kind of brings us full circle on this conversation. We started on the playoffs, ALCS going on right now. As a baseball fan, I know you have some friends with the with that Rays team. Yeah. As a baseball fan, I wanted to see Astros Yankees. Yeah, I wanted to see the best versus the best.
Sure.
And we're getting that right now. Mm-hmm. Gerrit Cole, Justin Verlander, you on the Yankee side, you've got all those bashers in the lineup. It has to be cool just as a baseball guy like you to sit back and watch the amount of talent that is on both sides in the lineup, in the rotation, in the bullpen, and it is just a back and forth just grudge match between those two.
Yeah, they're two juggernauts in the game right now, and you know, you want homers, you'll get homers. You want great defense, you'll get that too. And you want great starting pitching, you'll get that. It's like, you're absolutely right. I think it's the series everybody wanted to see. And so far it's proven to be just that. I mean, you know, I think that they're not scoring as many runs as maybe they would hope, but like, you're not going to score runs off. The playoffs are different. It's like, you know, pitchers get better in the playoffs. They throw harder. Their stuff is nastier, but, man, it's interesting. I don't really know if I'm leaning one way or another to see what team is better. I mean, I keep looking at, like, this guy DJ LeMahieu is unreal. Like, people in New York don't even realize how good of a player this guy is. Like, all he does is hit, and it's just like
and he could play anywhere on the field too.
And he could play anywhere on the field. It's like that was probably one of the best free agent signs of all last offseason. But it's good. Correa is playing well for Houston right now. He's made some unbelievable defensive plays. Bregman is Bregman. It's like they're interesting.
You bring up Correa's defensive play.
Yeah.
Game two.
That was awesome.
The play that he made, Altuve, if I'm trying to remember the play correctly.
It was hit hard.
Altuve couldn't corral it. It's a loose ball behind second base, and the Yankees runner is coming in to try to score.
Mm-hmm.
And the play that Correa makes to grab the ball, throw it home, a bullet on the money.
A strike.
To get him out. How difficult is that for Correa to pull off?
Man, might be really easy for him. I don't know.
But just in general.
I think it's a super hard play. I mean, first of all, it's a throw they don't practice ever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, his instinct just took over. I mean, it was almost Jeter and Oakland-esque. Like,
yeah.
If we're really thinking about, like, you know, how big of a play it was, like, and how nobody would think to do that. And he did it. He put it right on the money, right in, you know, right in Torino's glove, and he had, you know, three steps to plant and make a tag. It's like, he's got an unbelievable arm. He saved that game, and then he ended that game.
Yeah, no kidding. And
talk about taking over.
And on that defensive play, John Smoltz was basically saying, Yankees did nothing wrong.
No, they had to take that chance.
Yeah.
Nine times, maybe not against him, but like 9 times out of 10 against any other defense, they score.
Mm-hmm.
Because the shortstop is not near the play, but instincts took over. He decided to sprint over at a ground ball to the second baseman when he probably didn't even have like a care in the world or thought that he was going to miss it. And it's just like, it's like backing up an infielder, like what outfielders do when, you know, it's a play, you know, in the right center gap, like both of them converge, center fielder gets it, right fielder backs him up. Correa did that, but with second base and a shortstop, and then pivoted and threw probably a 93-mile-an-hour fastball right at Chirinos' glove and saved the game, and then took it upon himself. He's like, I'm tired of playing. I'll just hit an oppo jack and end it.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
So we saw renderings come out a few weeks ago from the group in Nashville that wants to bring Major League Baseball to this city.
Okay.
I don't know if you had a chance to see the renderings.
No, I haven't.
It's basically a retractable roof stadium on the other side of the river from Broadway, in between Nissan Stadium and Korean Veterans Boulevard.
Okay.
I don't know how you can put a baseball stadium there in that
spot. Traffic problem we already have.
Exactly. But there's just, I don't know if the word is momentum, but there's a lot of stuff happening right now behind the scenes of this group wanting to bring Major League Baseball to Nashville. Do you feel like this city would be ready for Nashville, as you get a chance to look at the renderings?
That's really, really cool.
That's right beside Nissan Stadium.
So it would have the the skyline in the background.
Yes. Yes. Right, right on the river.
The pedestrian bridge would go right into the stadium.
That's really, really cool. I think it would. I mean, if you look at, I mean, I was at the Titans game 2 weeks ago. It was sold out. I mean, I know they're playing the Bills, but still, like, it was a hot ticket. I go to Preds games all the time. They're sold out every single night.
You can't get tickets
to the Predators because they're good, and it's now what, the number one franchise in all of sports,
mm-hmm.
in North America, and it just seems like this city is just it's booming, for lack of a better word. I mean, every time I come back for the off season, there's 13, 14, 15 cranes in the skyline, and some other building is coming up. So, saying that, I think Nashville would be great for Major League Baseball. I really do. I think if they got the stadium right and they got the right people to take over the team, and I don't know if they would need another team to match up, make even numbers in a different league, but as long as they got the stadium right and they didn't Miami Marlins it and do that, like, I would say they make a 30,000 seat stadium, something small, something intimate, something different than everything else, because it's hard to start a fan base for a baseball team when, you know, there hasn't been one ever here, and people are already, I would say, split between Braves and Reds and
some Cardinals, some Cubs.
Yeah, some Cardinals, some Cubs. Well, Cubs are everywhere, but it'd be interesting. I hope they do it. I think it'd be great for baseball. I think everybody loves the city of Nashville, and I think it's time for Nashville to start showing its teeth in terms of Major League Baseball, and for people to really, really see how great of a city this is.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for stopping by the studio, taking time out of your off season to come by and talk some baseball. Enjoyed it, and hope we can do it again soon.
Let's do it again real soon. Thank you for having me.
Good stuff there from Kurt Casale, again with the Cincinnati Reds, formerly with the Vanderbilt Commodores. Nice enough to come in studio with us, mm-hmm. Calvin. Great stuff. I know you really enjoyed all the analytical stuff with him of Rap Soto and breaking pitches and all that with him.
Yes. Well, I got, normally when I've asked a question about that stuff in the past to a lot of our guests, a lot of it's been, you know, it's part of the equation and we kind of do stuff with it here and there. But Kurt actually walked you through the process of how it's used and how he incorporates it with the pitching coaches, and then how he uses that in game to kind of inform what he's informing within his decision making, right? And mm-hmm. when he determines what a hitter's doing within an at bat, then he takes the information that they've gathered on the pitcher about what type of a pitcher they are, whether, you know, they have great vertical movement, great horizontal movement, or whatever. He uses that to then game plan in that way, and that is such a great lens that you don't get. One, a guy who's a catcher, who's so involved in every at-bat. He's incredible. The guy in every at-bat who's putting down the signs in this mental game of baseball where catchers have to be a step ahead all the time. Mm-hmm. And you got a great perspective there of how new technology is being used for the good. And the Reds are certainly going to be on the forefront of that, like we talked about last week with the hiring of Kyle Bodie.
Yep, absolutely. So good stuff there. And then I thought he really peeled back the curtain on Sonny Gray.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
How successful Sonny Gray was. Sonny Gray's line this year, 11-8, 2.87 ERA. He had 205 strikeouts in 175 innings. He's never really been a strikeout-laden pitcher, but all of a sudden this season, Sonny Gray averaging more than 9 strikeouts per 9 innings.
Yeah.
And just a fantastic season. It was really cool to hear Kurt's breakdown of Sonny, considering how close they are. Played together at Vanderbilt.
Both live in the mid-state.
And they just saw each other this week. And the fact that he's saying that he's a better pitcher now than he was at Vanderbilt. And he was fantastic at Vanderbilt.
He was an all-SEC guy at Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
And it just makes a lot of sense, though, that Sonny Gray is a strikeout pitcher with that hammer curveball he has. I'm glad. Well, I would say the way pitching is going in the MLB greatly favors Sonny Gray's arsenal with that curveball, where we're seeing the bridles get taken off with it. Like Kurt said in the interview, there was kind of a hiatus from the curveball because of a lot of concerns about what it does to your arm and stuff like that, and everyone got caught up in the slider. But with the way pitching is going right now, only seems to be benefiting Sonny Gray because he threw a curveball on almost a quarter of his pitches.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crazy amount.
It really is.
Especially when he's only throwing his fastball 28% of the time.
So as we wrap things up here, we both agreed last week that it was going to be Nats-Yankees in the World Series. That was our prediction going into
because Calvin
series.
Was sticking by Calvin's prediction from the beginning of the year, yes.
Yes. And we were both all aboard the Nationals bandwagon at that point.
Yeah, and for sure.
Still weren't complete believers in the Cardinals. Yeah. And you just hate to see the Cardinals lose in the playoffs. I mean,
yeah. You hate to see it.
You hate to see it. tongue in cheek, I can't stand the Cardinals. Are you still thinking Yankees-Nats? Or are you kind of changed? Are you thinking this is going to go the Astros way now?
Well, I'm going to stick with my opinion of last week, which was Calvin. I'm speaking myself in the third person here.
Yeah, there you go.
Calvin at the beginning of the year is, of course, going to be right. And the Yankees are absolutely going to make it to the World Series because I said they would at the beginning of the year. However, the Astros look like the better team and the team I would bet on if I were a betting man. So that is me weaseling out of it because I've been doing that since July because that's how strongly I've believed in the Astros for a while now. As everybody has, they're probably the best team in baseball. And that's my way of weaseling out of it and saying, I would bet on the Astros, but I'm sticking to my guns with the Yankees very weakly.
Well, I think I may have overthought the Astros lost the LCS when they lost game 4 and were forced to pitch Gerrit Cole in game 5.
Yeah, yeah.
They're still up 2-1. At the timing of this podcast, so we'll see.
And they hopefully they won't get rained out anymore.
I know, right? And Greinke can now pitch.
Yes,
on full rest.
That only benefits the Astros.
Verlander can now pitch at full rest. So
what's going to be interesting to watch is the Nationals layoff they have now because the Yankees and Astros still have some games to play. They have more to be figured out, but the Nationals have all this time off.
They haven't had more than one day off since. I have no idea. I haven't looked at the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, they had to play in the wild card game.
But they've been just at it, and now they're going to get a week off.
And it's a very common narrative that teams who get time off tend to come back, and they're a little flat-footed. They aren't in the same groove. And for a team who we talk about who's on fire right now, sitting on your couch, which is not what they're doing, but sitting in the cages or something like that is not the same as what they might see if Luis Severino is on the mound, or if Gerrit Cole's on the mound.
Yeah, exactly. So that's all we have for you today here on the Home Plate Podcast. Hope you enjoyed Kirk Casale, his visit as much as we did. And we will be talking to you again soon, hopefully next week, right here on the Home Plate Podcast. ESPN 102.5 The Game and thegamenashville.com.
Hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.